Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Professor Emeritus Fred Saber in this episode. Professor Saber is the first winner of the Charles A. Wedemeyer Award, highlighting his scholarly activity and international status in the world of distance education. I'm talking with Dr. Fred Saber, Professor Emeritus of Educational Technology at San Diego State University. Fred has authored more than 100 articles and chapters in books and has the distinct honour to be the first winner of the Charles A. Wedemeyer Award. He has a wealth of international and scholarly experience in distance education and is founder and editor of distanceeducator.com. Fred, thanks for talking with me.
It is a pleasure.
Great. Fred, can we get started with a brief overview of your career and publications?
Yes. As you may have thought, I was born and raised in Iran, and in the 60s, most of the population in underdeveloped countries of the time were living in rural areas, over 75% of the population, and they had no access to education. So my idea was to learn about broadcasting and help educational industries and the government to broadcast education to those people who did not have access to formal schooling. And so I wrote my master's thesis at San Francisco State University about the use of telecommunication satellites in education. That was the technology of choice in 1969, and so I selected that topic as my master's thesis.
Yeah.
And then I went to Syracuse University and wrote my doctoral dissertation on implementation of educational radio and television in developing countries. And unbeknownst to me, the government was speaking to Syracuse University, and they were planning to have my faculty, my entire faculty, to come to Iran. And when I went back home to start working, I was appointed as the managing director of educational radio and television of Iran. And it was a sort of an interesting situation because I had my entire faculty in my office as my technical advisors. Not only that, but other luminaries from Michigan State University, from the University of Southern California. And so it was really a unique opportunity for building an organization that was able to help the Ministry of Education to propagate educational services throughout the country. Mm-hmm. So I did that for 5 years, and of course, transfer of technology became extremely controversial, among other things, in that country. And as I'm sure you have noticed in the news, that controversy is still going on.
Yeah.
So I came back to the United States and started my new career at University of Connecticut, pretty much doing the same thing, using broadcasting to help five of our regional campuses around the state of Connecticut. And it was around the beginning of 1980s that the entire field of media and technology was going from analog to digital. Mm-hmm. That was a major transformation. And I thought that if I wanted to do research in that area, I should go to a more academic job, not a managerial job. So I went to San Diego State University and started my research. I was very lucky again. I received a grant from Northern Telecom, a company known as Nortel later on, and that was the phone company for Canada. And it was at the beginning of integrated voice and data systems, so they provided me with three computers that could integrate data and voice on the same line, oddly called DV1. So we had three of these units, each of which cost at the time $100,000.
Wow.
So we started doing research on how to use integrated media, data, voice, and later on video for what became later on known as online education. Of course, at the time, we were using landlines, you know, just copper wire, before coaxial cables and other media became available. But later on, the internet came along, and so the rest is more familiar to your audience because the entire field changed into distance education or online learning or an online education as we know it now. I started writing about how to use integrated telecommunication systems for distance education and started publishing in the American Journal of Distance Education, which lagged a little, I should say, behind Australia and Canada, that were a little bit ahead of the United States in having their distinct journal dedicated to distance education. But our colleague Michael Moore at Pennsylvania State University initiated that journal, and I think I published in the second issue of the journal the article on integrated data voice system for distance education, and that's how I started publishing in the American Journal of Distance Education and other journals.
Fantastic. And that dates back to the 80s. So your online learning career actually stems right back to when computers first became viable for use in distance education.
That is true. It was conceivable even in the area of radio television to do that through telecommunication satellites. But satellites were extremely expensive and extremely complicated in terms of use in schools and in each classroom. So the personal computer was a game changer, a real revolution in putting learning services at the fingertip of the student and as well as the faculty. And so the computer really changed everything, as you know.
Absolutely. Fred, can we reach back into some of the themes that your work has provided over the 100-plus articles and book chapters that you've written, including those that you sense are still pertinent today? And actually, I'm really interested, too, to just explore whether or not you, from time to time, go back to those initial articles that you've written and reflect on how things have changed over those years.
Well, things have changed a lot in terms of technology, in terms of software and hardware systems, in terms of new concepts such as the use of artificial intelligence, OER, and a lot of other affordances that we have in media technologies today. But at the same time, they haven't changed really a lot because the basic structure of education, the basic structure of K-12 and university education hasn't really changed all that much. We have spent a lot of time and effort on explaining what distance education is, defining it, explaining its ramification for education. And there was a time, I should say, in the early 90s that we were hoping that the new online education would change the way that education was conducted, learning and teaching was conducted in universities. But except a very few institutions, I haven't seen that dramatic change. So yes, we have changed a lot in terms of our capabilities, our affordances, our technologies. But at the same time, we have not been able to change the structure of education and make our new concepts accepted by universities. I used to say jokingly to my colleagues that as instructional designers, universities would allow us to do anything that we want to do as long as we do not make a difference.
I've had the benefit of reading the book that you authored with Dr. Rick Scherer as well, to do with transactional distance and adaptive learning. Are the sorts of shifts that you're proposing identified in that book? And perhaps it might be useful for our listeners if you could actually go through some of those.
Well, you know, we have talked about those issues with you, and since you have been a contributor to my publication, my weekly newsletter, distanceeducator.com, and so we sort of share some of these ideas. I think that we still have an industrial structure for education, and we haven't really moved into a post-industrial structure. Distance education in its new form, in the era of internet, if you will, is a post-industrial model, and we are still in the industrial mode. I'm not sure how educational credits, for example, structured in different countries of the world, but here in the United States, we still use the Carnegie model of 3 credit hours, which has no pedagogic basis. It was basically decided by the steel magnate, the steel industry lord, if you will, who wanted to give to universities, you know, give them money for their operations, donate to universities. And they had no way of quantifying how his donations were going to be used. And so therefore, the Carnegie model came about as 3 hours worth of lecturing to students. And that industrial model has stayed there regardless of learning that takes place. And so we need to move beyond that industrial model. If a learner is learning faster or in a different way than sitting in a classroom for 3 hours and listening to a lecture, then we need to acknowledge that. And you would say that, you know, with all the new technologies that we have, with adaptive learning, with artificial intelligence, with multimedia presentations, there are variability among students in their ability to learn, but we haven't acknowledged that. We are still stuck with that lockstep industrial mode. So if I want to put it in a nutshell, that is one of the changes that needs to be taking place. And it is not easy to do that. I acknowledge that. You know, having a 3 credit hour course is measurable. It's something that governments can respond to. You know, you sit in a class for 3 hours and you get compensated by the government. It's very simple. It is not as simple as measuring the learning of each learner and then compensating the university according to that. That's very complicated. But I think we have the technology now to do that, and we haven't really done that yet.
Great, and that's a good segue to also put in a plug for the book, which we will link to. So thinking back to some of the other work as well, more broadly, you've got a publication span of some 40 years plus. What are some of the key themes that you'd like to pick out from that history, just to highlight for our listeners?
Well, the literature has grown a lot. 40 years ago, the number of attendees to conferences for distance education were very, very few. I remember when Dr. Moore started the teaching and learning conference in Madison, Wisconsin. When I attended, I think, the second or the third conference, that is now, I would say, 30-some-odd years old, 15, 20 people were in attendance.
Yeah.
Now the same conference brings in 1,000 people, 1,200 people, so forth and so on. And so the number of people that are scholars in the field has grown tremendously, and the number of literature that is published has grown tremendously. However, we are in education one of the few disciplines, if you will, that are not working based on specific theoretical or paradigms in the field. There are articles that, you know, I go through a lot of articles during the week to select a few, to select 6 or 7 for my newsletter. Yeah. And very few of them are based on a theory. And not only that, very few share the same theoretical framework. Mm-hmm. And so to be a discipline, to become a discipline in distance education, we should define our theories. You know, I'm not suggesting that we should have only one theory. Far from that. I think we should have competing theories. But we shouldn't start from scratch in each article. You know, sometimes when I come across an article, it is as though distance education has had no history, no conceptual development.
Yeah.
They're starting from scratch, and they are defining new terms. We are defining new terminology that are slightly different than the terminology of another article, but you would never know whether this is the same construct. Is it a different construct? Why we have a different construct? And so we don't have a common language among our theories. And to become a discipline, we need to be more cognizant of that fact.
And of course, your website too does provide some form of gravity, if you like, around the concept of distance education rather than online learning. I wonder if you could just explore the potential differences across those two terms. So why I ask is a lot of the guests that have appeared on the podcast do actually have a very strong distance education background, and online education has been an extension of that understanding. I'm just really interested in how you would equate distance education and online learning, what the relationship across them is.
Online learning is just another modality of distance education. You know, we could have this, you know, historically in the United States, distance education started as a book club. It was a book club, and people used to go to a city in upstate New York. The name will come to me in a second or two. There were conferences, there were presentations, so forth and so on. But at the same time, they would be subscribing to a series of books that would be sent to them. And then they would compare notes and would get back together again the next year. So that was the mode of distance education in the agricultural era. And as we moved into an industrial era, then we moved into radio and television, and then telecommunication grew in different ways. You know, we went to satellites and then terrestrial systems such as cable television or microwave transmission, and now we have the internet. So the mode of transmission of information has changed, but the primary concept of distance education has not.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, and I think worthwhile for anyone interested in online learning to investigate distance education literature and its development, because online learning didn't come as a surprise at all to distance educators.
No, it did not. It was a transition. You know, it was like when I was at the University of Connecticut, we were broadcasting to 5 regional campuses. And in our office, which was shared by several other faculty members and several other colleagues, we were also playing with this thing called an Apple IIe computer. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, you know, 2 computers got connected, and we had messaging, text exchange, text communication. And so that became a mode of quote-unquote online learning. You know, for some time, just basic email was a form of presenting instructional information. And again, it wasn't one medium or the other. It was broadcasting on television, but at the same time using email to keep in touch with our students. You know, it was a sort of a hybrid, if you will. And then, of course, the internet simplified everything. It brought everything into one medium and brought it all together. So it was a transition. It was an evolution, if you will.
Yeah. And I think over that time, too, you've been able to assimilate such ideas or developments as artificial intelligence into that distance education framework.
Correct. I mean, there are many, many new concepts, as you know, more than I do. And, you know, these are just evolutionary ideas. But again, going back to my criticism, there are some folks who think that distance education started with online education. Well, that's far from it.
Absolutely. Well, Fred, we're now at the start of a new decade. 2020 is just upon us. What are your observations about online learning and education at the present time? What are some of the thoughts you would have there, in addition to those you've already expressed about the need for education to transform?
I think that one of my recommendations is to look at how we conduct research. I used to ingest, tell my students that I really don't care about the topic of your dissertation, and they would be shocked because, you know, they would come back and say that, how come Fred doesn't care about my topic? Well, that wasn't really true. I mean, I was definitely interested in their topic, but what I wanted to highlight was that the method that they would use to study their topic was perhaps more important than the topic itself, because the topic would change. I mean, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, their focus of interest would shift, but the methodology would remain. And so the methodology is something that we really have to consider as we make progress in our field. And the reason I say that is because, in going back again to the concept of industrial education, I think our methods of observation are still not in line with the new concepts of distance education. Now, you know, a lot of our colleagues are doing phenomenological studies, which is a great change, and I welcome that. But at the same time, when we decide on a phenomenon to study, a construct to study, we go back to what I call comparative studies. We take two groups of students, we expose one group to one treatment and another group to another treatment, and then we compare their learning scores.
Yeah.
Well, when you compare the scores of a group of student to another group of student, what you are going to miss are the individual differences, and then invariably we come up with this statistically no significant difference studies. If you take a look at research in education other than the new phenomenological studies, they show no significant difference. And the reason for that is that we have to focus on individual learners. We have to study the behavior of each individual learner instead of focusing on comparative studies of groups of learners. And so that is one thing that I would recommend highly to focus on in the future.
It's an interesting observation, because learning analytics, of course, also tend to treat students as groups rather than as individuals.
Right. And again, you know, this is something that you have observed, and you have conveyed that to me in the past, because many universities have now co-opted, if you will, ideas from distance education, and they have basically used it in their current structure. And so that's a struggle. You know, analytics could be used for a group of students or could be used for understanding one particular learner and helping that person. And I think those are the kinds of things that we need to address. Change is very difficult. It is generational at times. You know, we want change to happen in our lifetime. You know, I've learned because of the historical upheavals that I have been exposed to that change may not occur in my lifetime. And it, you know, it may take at least one generation, if not more generations. But at the same time, we have to start from somewhere. And so we have to be cognizant of not using new concepts, new technologies, new affordances with the old structures.
Fred, can we move on to the research you'd most like to see? If I was to give you an extensive research budget, what would you invest in?
Well, I would like to focus on the use of systems theory for research, and the reason I emphasize systems science is because of, you know, new concepts that are the outgrowth of complexity theory, and a focus on self-organized characters of learners. How do they learn? How do they self-organize learning? what are the emerging properties of learning activities. So the new complexity theory, the new systems theory, has given us a lot of tools that we didn't have before. But at the same time, we need to have that systems concept, because distance education consists of many variables, many variables. It's a complex idea. We sometimes try to simplify it and say that it is just one idea. But, in the book that you mentioned, Transactional Distance and Adaptive Learning, I have outlined several subsystems for distance education, going from hardware systems to software to telecommunications, instructional systems, curriculum systems, management systems, societal systems, and global systems. And under each of those systems, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of other subsystems. So we are dealing with a lot of complex issues: the social environment of the learner, the global environment in which we live. You are in New Zealand, I'm here in San Diego, California, and this is an amazing thing. This is an amazing event. So that's the global nature of communication today. And so there are many variables, and we need to consider all of them in a coherent manner, in relation to each other. And so that's why I highly would recommend a systems approach to research, particularly in its new version of complexity theory.
That's excellent. That resonates with my own work as well.
Frida, well, I'm glad to hear that.
Can we conclude with two people you'd recommend as legends of online learning? One whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you now, and someone you think otherwise has an important perspective to share?
Well, again, I go back to the concept of discipline. I consider myself a follower of Charles Wedemeyer, who introduced the idea of systems theory, at least here in the United States, and to a certain extent in Great Britain, and from there, from the BBC and the Open University, that idea was transferred to India and the developing world. And Michael Moore, who was a protege of Charles Wedemeyer, and I followed their research, and it goes back to my idea of establishing a discipline and not starting from scratch.
So Charles would definitely be one that you would recommend. So.
And Michael Moore, and Michael Moore, whose research I have followed, and what I have written is basically based on his concept of systems theory of distance education.
Both very inspired choices. Fred, it's been wonderful talking with you. You are indeed a leader and legend of online learning, and I really appreciate this time to talk with you.
Well, thank you very much for this conversation. I appreciate it very much.
You can learn more about Fred and his work and find a link to the various works we mentioned from our website. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.